Les colloques du Collège de France.
Hello, it's a pleasure to welcome you for this meeting on oxidative stress and therapy response in cancer. I'd like to thank all our friends and colleagues for coming despite the heat wave, some of them from very far. Masi Yamamoto came from Japan on this occasion, and many of you dared to face the heat wave to come here in Collège de France. So my introduction will be short. Our own interaction with oxidative stress really started by studying the PML protein that you'll hear of in the at the very end of this day, the lecture today, realizing it's exquisitely sensitive to oxidative stress. And for this, for me, this was really an eye-opener, which allowed me to dive into this literature, which I must confess I didn't know very well, and discover how interesting and how relevant it was to health and disease. And I took two years of courses on oxidative stress in different conditions here in Collège de France, and this is the second meeting dedicated to this condition here. It's a rapidly moving field that has really been renewed recently thanks to molecular tools, and it moved away from, you know, classical aging cream nuclear supplements for food to prevent aging, towards really now very clear important mechanisms such as ferroptosis. And we're lucky here to have two of the world experts on ferroptosis, which has popped really everywhere now in physiology and pathology. And we also have the chance of having two real living legends in the field here that will give these 1 hour long introductory talk. Helmut Siers here online, and fortunately he was planned to come, but he was advised for medical reasons not to do so, and I thank him very much for having accepted to do this presentation online, and Masi Yamamoto, who respectively discovered the role of oxidative stress in physiological regulation and the role of the NRF2 CAPE1 complex in the molecular regulation of stress response. So, without further ado, I'd like to leave the floor to Helmut. Thank him again so much for arranging this online presentation and educating us on the multifaceted role of oxidative stress in health and disease. Helmut, thank you very much.
So, thank you very much. Can you hear me now? Okay. Professor De Tate, thank you for the kind introduction, and I will try to do a tour d'horizon through the oxidative stress role in health and disease. The Janus phase of oxygen in aerobic metabolism is well known. We need oxygen for bioenergetics to have the anabolic and also catabolic reactions and the redox control. But oxygen has also the Janus phase of causing damage, oxygen toxicity, and leading to cell death. So there is a balance between too much and too little. And oxidative stress is defined as an imbalance between the oxidants on the one side and the antioxidants in favor of the oxidants, which then would lead to a disruption of redox signaling and control and molecular damage. Now, I'd like to start out with the basic concept that living organisms are open metabolic systems. There are flow equilibria, and that has been already noted by Heraclitus about 2,500 years ago, Pantare, everything flows. So these flow equilibria generate steady states, and life is characterized by operating at non-equilibrium steady states. In other words, we are not at thermodynamic equilibrium. And this maintenance of the redox steady state is a continual challenge. And that is what is now called the physiological oxidative stress, due stress, the good stress. Whereas if there is too much oxidant challenge, supraphysiological, that's oxidative distress. Hans Selye, in 1936, initiated the concept of the adaptation syndrome for stress-related reactions of the body. In a small note in Nature, a syndrome produced by diverse noxious agents. And in 1975, he introduced the term eustress that I have mentioned, the good stress as opposed to distress. And the title of this little booklet, it says, how to use stress as a positive force to achieve a rewarding lifestyle. So this concept is not only in chemical and medical context, but also in psychiatric and psychological context. Now, these low equilibria in the open system are depicted here in a in an overview fashion. On the top, you see in blue several the sources that generate oxidants, and this is under enzymatic control, various nature. So the sources generate, and on the right-hand side, there are the sinks, the removal mechanisms, which are also under control. So in yellow, you see the steady state of these, but certainly not all of them, but some of the major redox-related molecules. And there is the physiological exposure of these all the time, and low exposure generates the reaction with specific targets. That is the eustress, and that is redox signaling, and leading to maintenance of normal physiology. Whereas on the right-hand side, the unspecific targets, oxidative distress, disruptive signaling, and disease. And mentioned here already, the adaptive responses, NF-kappa-B, NRF2, and the hypoxia-inducible factors. And it turns out that hydrogen peroxide is a central redox signaling molecule. Here you see across the plasma membrane of the cells, there is a large gradient of hydrogen peroxide. And in the middle, you see this is micromolar concentration. So outside the cell, it's usually about 1 micromolar, 1 to 5 micromolar in the vascular bed. And in the cells overall, it's 0.01 micromolar, that is 10 to the minus 8 in the nanomolar range. So if there is a gradient of about 100-fold between 1 nanomolar and 100 nanomolar, and this is the physiological range for proliferation, migration, angiogenesis, and many other normal processes. So if there's a little higher concentration, steady state concentration, there is the recruitment of the adaptive responses. And for example, the NRF2 KEAP1 system of Professor Yamamoto that you will hear about later in detail. And then even higher, there is the recruitment of the NF-kappa B system, the inflammation system, and the results will be fibrogenesis, tumor growth, metastasis, and finally growth arrest and cell death. All these cell death mechanisms will be addressed by Professor Conrad. Now, I would like to go a little bit more into hydrogen peroxide. Just coming back to the very basic that the first electron is put on oxygen to make the superoxide radical anion, which in the protonated form is the parahydroxyl radical. The next step leads to a stable molecule, hydrogen peroxide, which can be kept in a bottle. It's stable. And the next reduction step leads to the most reactive radical, that is the hydroxyl radical. And the fourth one is, then leads to water. So this is the basis of the four one electron reduction steps that are used in cytochrome oxidase to generate ATP at the mitochondria. Now, in Paris, the term oxygen was actually coined by Antoine Lavoisier. I thought I would mention this. Lavoisier, Priestley, and Scheele discovered the role of oxygen. And interestingly, at Paris as well, Louis-Jacques Thénard discovered hydrogen peroxide. He called it low oxygené, the oxygenated water, H2O2. And that's Thénard, 1818, Observations sur les nouvelles combinaisons entre les oxygen et divers acides. I would like also to mention that Thénard was a member of the Collège de France. Now, hydrogen peroxide was looked since 1818, looked at in many different ways, but it was difficult to show in normal metabolism of eukaryotes. In bacteria, it was found in the 1920s and also in fungus and so on. But in H2O2, it was debated. For example, Keeling and Hartree in the UK, they said contrary to the view that H2O2 is generally formed in cells during respiratory processes, there are several arguments against this. Or Britton Chance, who first showed the catalase compound 1 in 1947, was trying to demonstrate H2O2 in normal cells, and he formulated that quantitative evidence for the existence of significant amounts of H2O2 is lacking, since catalase, by the virtue of its peculiar capacity of the catalytic reactions, literally destroys the evidence. And the reason why it was so difficult was that one was looking at the Soray band, about 400 nanometer for the catalase heme. And you see here there's a nice difference between catalase and catalase compound one. And but there was too much noise in the signals. And there's also a band further into the red, in the near infrared. There's a peak at 660. And the isospecific point here is 640. So this charge transfer band actually made it possible to detect H2O2 in intact cells. And this is what I was doing quite some time ago, using the intact perfused liver of the rat with a light guide that sees about 20 million cells. And this is the crucial experiment that in the lower panel here is oxygen. If you take oxygen away, there is this defection that means the loss of the catalase compound one. If you reoxygenate, it comes back. And importantly, if you deplete the compound one with a hydrogen donor for catalase compound one, you deplete it, and that is non-additive to the loss, showing that it's a very specific detection of H2O2. And then one can titrate with the methanol as hydrogen donor to find the H2O2 concentration. And this is about 10 nanomolar, 10 to the minus 8 molar H2O2 you see here in the center, that in a review with Chance and Alberto Bavarez from Argentina, and after some work with Nozomu Oshino together, we came up with 10 nanomolar, and the steady state concentration overall with superoxide, we have three orders of magnitude lower. You see here the relationship between the subcellular organelles, which I will come back to in some more detail. So H2O2 is a fast-acting and also transcription-independent signaling agent. It reacts directly. You don't have to wait for new transcription and translation. So on the top of this table, you see the 10 nanomolar again, the overall, which of course is just a number for orientation, because inside the cell, there's quite a landscape of different normal H2O2 concentrations. For example, in the cytosol, it is relatively low, between 0.1 and about 2 nanomolar. In the mitochondrial matrix is higher, and very high, 700. It is in the lumen of the endoplasmic reticulum. The peroxisome has certainly a relatively high concentration. Lysosome, to my knowledge, there is no information of H2O2 steady-state concentrations in the lysosome, and the nucleus has relatively low concentrations. Now, at the level of the cell, this landscape can be depicted like this, for example. If there's a growth factor that reacts with this receptor, there's an activation of the superoxide producing nitric oxide, NADPH oxidase activity, which leads to superoxide, which then dismutates with the extracellular superoxide dismutase to H2O2, which then comes back into the cell with aquaporins, which are also called peroxyporins, into the cell. And then in the cell, there are different reactivities between the mitochondria, the endoplasmic reticulum, the peroxisome, and other places. I will get into that in more detail later on. I'd briefly like to mention that hydrogen peroxide is ubiquitous. It is produced in the surface of the ocean up to 200 nanomolar, about 20 meters deep in the surface of the ocean. And also in our food, hydrogen peroxide is a ubiquitous component of beverages, as Sadowska Bartosz and Bartosz have recently put together. I just want to mention, for example, in the breast milk, human breast milk, there was measured 20 micromolar H2O2. And in honey, because the bee provides glucose oxidase, it generates a lot of H2O2 in honey. And freshly brewed coffee or tea from the polyphenols that are in them generate H2O2. And cooked foods, beans, carrots, also our body fluids. Professor Barry Halliwell from Singapore, he showed that in the urine there's H2O2 and in other fluids. Now, I'd like to briefly address what redox signaling in an overview is all about, the so-called thiol switches. And here you see on the top a cysteine in the protein, and which is dissociated to as a cysteine thiolate. The cysteine thiolate then reacts with H2O2 to form the sulfenate, and this then changes the properties of the protein so that the protein can use this as a cue for further reactions. The sulfenate can be further oxidized to the sulfenate and even further to the sulfonate. Professor Toledano in Paris has shown also the sulfuredoxin. It can go back to sulfenate. The further fate of the sulfenate can be to react with another thiol to form a disulfide, or it can react with a glutathione molecule, GSH, to glutathionate the protein here. And this can be then reduced back by glutaredoxin to the initial state, or on the disulfide can be reduced back by the thioredoxin. So there are several recovery systems, and these are backed up. For example, thioredoxin has the thioredoxin reductase systems. Also, and importantly, there is the hydrogen sulfide, a reactive sulfur species that can form the persulfide. And there's currently lots of interest in the biological role of the persulfidation of proteins. So this is, in a much nutshell, the reaction of cysteine thiolate with H2O2. And much research has been performed in this field of hydrogen peroxide sensing, signaling, and regulation of transcription factors. Marin et al. More than 10 years ago reviewed this, and I showed this just that the regulatory mechanisms by which hydrogen peroxide modulates the activity has been shown with bacteria, eukaryotes, and with mammalian cells. And here we have again the NRF2, NF-kappa-B that I mentioned, but several others as well. Now, the field has become with much more research in recent years to show that oxidative stress is a very differentiated state of oxidized and reduced proteins in the cell. Zacoble has put this together. He calls it in many shades of oxidative stress. For example, if you look at a protein that has just three redox active cysteines, there are eight possible cysteine redox states. And these can occur in different parts of one cell, or even in different parts of one subcellular organelle. And in addition, each of these cysteines that can be either reduced or oxidized can have different occupancy with so-called oxyptms, that is the post-translational modifications. And I mentioned, of course, already the glutathione, but there are many other post-translational modification. So there is what is called now a proteoform landscape. To put this into some kind of a logic for redox organization, together with my longtime colleague and friend Dean Jones, we have set out to try to put a logic for the orchestration of the redox systems. We called it the redox code. This is not like the genetic code or the Morse code, that is direct translation into from A to B, but it's more a set of principles, like the code Napoleon in the law field. And there we did the four principles of the redox code: high flux of redox system maintains bioenergetics and metabolic organization. The second one is that the redox coupled switches that I just mentioned, they link bioenergetics and metabolism to the macromolecular structure and function. The third is that activation, deactivation of the switches control the cellular organization in a spatio-temporal way. And I will get to that later on. And then, and importantly, and still a field of intense research, is that redox systems operate as integral networks that respond to variations also in the environment. This slide will try to formulate the principles from a concept point of view. I will start at the upper left. A cause leads to some input cues. These can be endogenous or exogenous. Endogenously, for example, by hormones, growth factors, cytokines, chemokines, or mechanical stress, and exogenous by the so-called exposome, that's the total exposure of exogenous cues, nutrients, micronutrients, gases, irradiation, chemicals, physicals, like noise and heat, and then the microbiome and the infections. And these input cues lead to the generation of the redox signal and the signal transduction. I mentioned some of these already: the NADPH oxidase makes superoxide, the electron transport chain H2O2, nitric oxide, synthase mix NO and the cis-methionine Elias mix H2S, among other sources. And this then leads to the changes in the switches, as I pointed out briefly before, sulfonylation, nitrosylation, persulfidation, glutathionylation. So the transcription factor systems get activated. And this leads to these networks, the integrated networks of redox signals. So the genome leads to the epigenome, especially at the histones, the epiproteome, transcriptome, and also changes in the regulatory RNAs. Of course, also metabolism is changed. The lipids are changed. The zinc, for example, in the metals, and the carbohydrates, the glycogen. This then leads to the responses, hormesis, preconditioning, and the known stress responses, oxidative stress response, unfolded protein, heat shock, and others, integrated stress response. And these responses lead either to health, survival, repair, proliferation, differentiation, migration, or to cell death, the regulated cell death programs, apoptosis, ferroptosis, and so on. On this vein, a little bit of examples. The first one here is the KEAP1, NRF2 of Professor Yamamoto's. There's much work has been made to show the thiol-based H2O2 signaling. It's actually not only H2O2, there are the electrophiles as well. There's a number of signaling molecules. But cysteines, for example, here the cysteine 226 and 613, but there are others, cysteine 251 and so on, as you may hear later on in the talk. And the circadian rhythm, the clock gene, cysteine 195 has been identified. And the optic, the pathfinding for the shaping of the optical tectum in morphogenesis by Professor Sophie Friss from Paris has been identified to be a cysteine irritant sensing. For example, the transient receptor potential channels a certain cysteine. And also in an axon regeneration, a certain thiol has been, or thiolate has been identified. Just for this example of the circadian rhythm, you see the H2O2 steady state variation over the 24-hour cycle. So the so-called set point is actually a moving target. As you see here also in individual cells, there's over the course of the day, we have circadian rhythms. And when this field is like in research, it's always good for surprises that H2O2 actually in specific neurons was found by a group from China to be active as a sleep to convert oxidative eustress into sleep drive by addressing one of the transient receptor potential channels M2 to in the substantia nigra to induce sleep. If there's too much H2O2, then there's fragmented sleep and there's distress, but a normal level leads to normal sleep. So suddenly there is a new area that has been studied in this topic. And there are many other examples, and one of them is the axon growth. This slide shows that the cellular outcome is largely, but of course not solely, regulated by the steady state concentration of H2O2. On the left side, you see that normal axonal growth is occurs in the green range between the 1 nanomolar to about close to 100. And if it is larger than 100 nanomolar, the growth cone is collapsing and there is axonal degeneration. On the other end, if there's too little H2O2, there's also low growth and impaired development. On the right side of this slide, you see what these stem cells, how they react in the green range, in the normal physiological range. There's normal proliferation, differentiation, and there's a balance between differentiation and self-renewal. And on the oxidative distress, on the higher exposure to H2O2, there's cell death. And on the lower, there's the impaired regenerative potential. There could be many more examples of this, but I think the point is that the low molecular concentration of H2O2 is crucial for processes of normal life. Also in wound healing, for example, H2O2 plays a role. And this example is what might be quite good for demonstration. That is the tadpole. When the tail is cut off, it's called amputation-induced reactive oxygen species. So on the lower left, you see the 2 minutes after the cutoff of the tail of this tadpole, there is an activation already of the H2O2 formation using the H2O2 sensor, high pair, which was introduced by Professor Belousov from Moscow about 20 years ago, and which gave a new burst to the field of H2O2 research. And if you further look on the lower part, the first with still some blue is 2 minutes, but then the first 6 hours after the amputation, 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, or there's the proliferation of the tail. And after 6 days, it then reaches its final length. As a summary of this part, diverse concentrations of H2O2 occur in the various organs, not only of the different cells, but the various organs, as shown here in the zebrafish embryo from Professor Sophie Friss from Paris, as you see here. And it's quite important that during certain times of the embryonic development, if there is an oxidation or a reduction that leads to charge remodeling of the histones, which have secondary effects on development. Now, I'd like to address a topic which I call the signaling slalom. What do I mean by that? This is the very nice depiction by Holmstrom and Finkel about this. You see the plasma membrane, and a growth factor signaling goes to the inside through the receptor, and then the recruitment of these subunits or the NADPH oxidase, which then to the outside generates O2 minus, which then has to come back to the inside through the aquaporins, peroxyporins that I mentioned. This is what could be called like a slalom around the plasma membrane. So it's counterintuitive why the signal would go inside and then outside before it does its job inside the cell. So there could be some explanation that is a little bit different. And you see here, practically on the upper left, the first part, just the same as I just have shown on the previous slide, there are gating possibilities or control with post-translational modifications of these peroxyporins. But also, there is the invagination of the plasma membrane at the caveolae. And that means that is under the control of caveolin 1. These are the lipid rafts. And these endosomes could then detach, and the NADPH oxidase produces superoxide inside this endosome, which then can be called a redoxosome. This shows in a very more simple cartoon, the stimulus leads to the formation of the endosome, which then contains the reactive oxygen species generation in the redoxosome. So there's a compartmentation of redox signaling by the NADPH oxidase derived reactive species, Ushio Fukai and the group of Engelhardt have studied these redoxosomes, which now come into focus much more. This little video provided by Professor Belousov shows how that works, linking the hyper probe for hydrogen peroxide to the EGF receptor. So after stimulation of the cells with growth factor, there is the formation of these redoxosomes. And they can then be finding a specific target by mechanisms which are now being elucidated in cell biological research. So these so-called microdomains show quite well how this slalom is probably circumvented. And in a depiction of this area, you have the formation again of the redoxosome, which then can do its job inside the cell, as we just have seen. But the redoxosomes can also be released as exosomes to the outside of the cell and reach a distant cell, maybe take some other cargo or recruit cargo when in the distant cell there's lots of activity currently in this area. The redoxosome can also enter an adjacent cell, but also there can be hydrogen peroxide signals going through the connections through the gap junctions. So the traffic between subcellular organelles and adjacent cells and distant cells is depicted by this presentation here. And an exciting new area of research is the further analysis due to also the possibility of novel techniques of hot topics in redox biology. And these are what can be called the transient or the ephemeral modalities of redox regulation. The microdomains, I just have shown an example, and there are others which are called nanodomains, and then transient membrane-less organelles, the biomolecular condensates that form by phase separation. The extracellular vesicles, the exosomes, the endosomes, and the redoxosomes, I just have mentioned. And more recently, even the intact transfer of mitochondria has been shown by some tunneling between cells recently. And of course, there are these ephemeral modalities by the neutrophils, which eject the extracellular traps, which is called the netosis. This is shown here, the neutrophil extracellular traps in bacterial information, for example. This is the neutrophil, and then it ejects the DNA and the myeloperoxidase that is ejected uses again hydrogen peroxide, in this case, to form a weapon using the chloride anion to form hypochlorite, which then attacks the bacteria. This field also has shown tremendous advances. For example, the released histones, when they are packaged in the DNA in the chromatin, they have their function, but when they are released in mitosis, they are toxic to neighboring cells. They are pore forming. So these aspects of histone H3 and H4, for example, have been shown to be toxic to the extracellular cell in bacterial killing. And this view of external killing has hydrogen peroxide is also causing oxidative stress in biology, for example, like the bombardier beetle that generates hydrogen peroxide and hydroquinone and then injects catalase and other enzymes to form an explosive gas. So this kind of this is not a net, but this is the same idea. I mentioned the different subcellular organelles, but they are not isolated. They interact with them in a very sophisticated way by what is known the membrane contact sites. This slide here shows the communication between the peroxisomes and other cell organelles. For example, the peroxisome interacts with the endoplasmic reticulum, with the mitochondria, with the lipid droplets and the lysosome. And not only in redox, but also in lipid metabolism, these are very hot topics in current research. Now, let's turn to the adaptive stress responses. I mentioned already the redox set point, the physiological range, which has also been called the homeodynamic space or the Goldilocks zone from a redox perspective, or the golden mean of healthy living, right? And then there is a new set point, which has been called the allostasis or the adaptive homeostasis, and preparation for change, that is the hormesis. So these concepts all address the maintenance and stress response adaptation. And this concept has been already exemplified by the preconditioning that King Mithridates VI, at the year of minus 100 before Christ, the preconditioning, he was, in order to prepare or to be alerted by poisoning, he treated low-dose poisons to precondition himself. And indeed, he was not killed by poison, but by some other means in his warfare. And the Paracelsus said that the dose makes the poison, dose it fastest venenum. And Claude Bernard, the milieu intérieur, the homeostasis. And later on, I mentioned Salier at the beginning of this lecture, heat shock response in the 1960s. And then in 85, the oxidative stress concept. And also the OxyR regulon was in the same year published by Bruce Ames. And then NF-kappa-B by Patrick Boyle, the hypoxia-inducible factor by Semenza. And then close to the turn of the century, Yamamoto's NIF2-KEAP1. So this is a long story of the adaptive responses. And this summary slide of that topic shows again the redox signaling and the adaptive responses. On the top, you see the different kinds of input, shear stress, growth factors, the exposome, that the virus, and so on. And then the signal generation. And in the middle, you see the different systems. I mentioned most of them already. I have not mentioned P53 and the FOXO system. And that leads to the response through transcription, activation, translation, and then the inflammatory response, stress adaptation, hypoxia response, and so on. And on the right-hand side, you see also the relationship of hydrogen peroxide when it reacts with divalent iron to form the hydroxyl radical, which then leads to the ferroptosis process. And Now, a brief delving into what could be called redox medicine. In an overview, the redox signaling integrates metabolism, gene expression, the interaction with the exposure from the outside, and, for example, also the holobiome, the host microbiota interactions. This is from a recent conference that Ana Ledo and Barbara Rocha had in Coimbra. Now, this overview should be discussed in a little bit more detail. On the left-hand side, you see the positive input that could also be used by what could be called redox medicine. That is the supply of the cofactors to the enzymes and the micronutrients, and to the supply of the bioactives like small molecule antioxidants, tocopherols, carotenoids, ascorbate, polyphenols, to use superoxide dismutase, the different redoxins, glutathione peroxidases, and catalase, and then personalized nutrition and network targets, redox drugs, and health behavior, lifestyle, mild hypoxia, intermittent fasting. These interventions, they lead to strengthen the oxidant redox system in a so-called redox tone in the normal range. So the endogenous oxidants contribute to the redox tone, and then the external ones, exposome and exercise. So if there is an increase in the redox tone, there is the recruitment of the hormetic response and the adaptive responses, stress resistance and resilience. And if there's too much of it, that we have the distress, which can also be used in redox medicine, as you see here on the right-hand side. And this is redox drugs that generate oxidants, redox cycling, and ionizing radiation, different kinds of radiation, photodynamic therapy, and an emerging field in recent years, the cold atmospheric plasma, which is being used in medicine to more specifically try to deliver oxidants. The major problem in all of this is to have it more precise rather than overall, which generates side effects that has been a problem in medical applications. So Chang Chen's group in Beijing has collected this reasoning in a nice figure. I'd briefly like to go through this. So much research has gone into finding the 5R. This is the right time of the cell cycle, the right season of the year, and also the right age of the patient may decide on what kind of treatment should be given. And then the spatiotemporal delivery in which organelles, which cell types, and which tissues, and in those the right targets, proteins, lipids, nucleic acids, and the right individuals and studies to find out more of the efficacy. Important also the release of the right level. And nanomedicine has now come up with several ways to determine the right levels in the right place. And then, of course, to deliver the right reactive species, positive or negative. Diagnosis is quite a problem because the different fields, on the top you see a number of different medical afflictions, several diseases and states, versus the different kinds of biomarkers that have been developed. And you see from a cluster analysis that it's quite diverse in different types of disease. And one single indicator is very difficult to use. One needs to use patterns of biomarkers, which is still a developing field. Regarding the cell death, oxidants play a role, as you will hear later on in Professor Konrad's lecture, of course, in much detail. I would just like to mention, in all of these different types of programs, cell death, oxidants play a role, and they are fine-tuned redox triggers. And the control of H2O2 and free iron is important as in the control of ferroptosis. In this respect, we have studied a glutathione peroxidase mimetic, which you see on the top. A seleno compound called F-selene, which, unlike its sulfur analog, has glutathione peroxidase activity. And glutathione peroxidase 4 is one of the essential proteins, enzymes that help in control of the ferroptosis. So there's a large literature on the selenium. A recent study from the group of Professor Mukesh in Bangalore uses derivatives of epsilon, which can now be up to 100-fold more active as a GPX for mimetic to help control ferroptosis. Whether this is of any future medical use will be, we'll have to see. So, in summary, I would like to conclude that there in the middle you see here the physiological range, the redox eustress, and to the right of it, you have a redox stress signaling threshold, which NF-kappa-B is detecting. In the middle, it's looked at by NIF2, KIP1, and on the left end, the threshold, you have the HIF1 systems. So this is the overview of the hormetic switches that summarizes the basic message that I wanted to convey in my lecture. One thing, it's always interesting to look for new concepts and new results. And for the young research in this field, there is always something very surprising to find. There's the secret ballet inside multivesicular bodies. Lipid bilayers have the capacity for self-assembly. And of course, proteins, also there are dynamic rearrangements. And this reminded me that in Art by Vasily Kandinsky, he has seen this a long time before the concentric cycles were shown in biology. So with this, I would like to thank you for your attention, and I would like to acknowledge some of my major colleagues, Enrique Cardenas, Nozomu Oshino, Dean Jones, Zubov Belousov, Carsten Berndt, Ryan Mayu, and many others, and my mentors, Theodor Bücher, Breton Schanz, and Bruce Ames. And I would like to thank the Deutsche Forschungsgemeinschaft and the National Foundation for Cancer Research for a long time financial research support. Thank you very much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.